Hello and welcome to another episode of Pakistanomy. My name is Uzair Yunus and I'm very excited and honored for this conversation today because we often talk about Pakistan's economy, what's going wrong, what reforms are needed with different experts and analysts. But the OG expert, I would say, Dr. Ishrat Hussain Saab, has done a lot of fantastic work on laying out what the issues in Pakistan's economy have been for a number of years. He has a recent and amazing and must-read book called Development Pathways 1947 to 2022, which I particularly love, and I've been slowly making my way through the entirety of the book, is because it compares what Bangladesh did, what India did, and what Pakistan did, and sort of gives this constructive comparison of what Pakistan can learn from two other countries that got independence and were born at the same time, but their development trajectories or pathways, as the book is titled, have diverged significantly. Dr. Saab does not need an introduction for those of you who may not know. He has been the central bank governor of Pakistan's State Bank of Pakistan. At that time, I think the bank itself went through immense reforms and game-changing reforms as an institution that have an impact to this day. He has worked with various governments in terms of trying to influence reforms, whether they be in the civil service side or on the institutional and policy side. And he's an academic and who has looked at the evidence and tried to, over the years, in great detail, put down the evidence for younger analysts like me and for the general public writ large about what Pakistan needs to do to truly meet its potential and the ambitions and aspirations of its young people. So when this book came out, I wanted to make sure that we had Dr. Saab on the podcast. I would have preferred to do it in person, but most of our conversations in this podcast are on Zoom. So Dr. Saab, thank you so much for taking out the time today and welcome to Pakistanomy.
Thank you very much, Uzair. It's a pleasure to be on this. You know, I've been avoiding TV interviews and podcasts last 6 or 7 years, but this is something which I wanted to do with you because this is a conversation rather than the anchor imposing their own agenda on the speaker. So that's why I enjoy talking to you, and that's why I'm here with you.
Well, thank you for that compliment. And in fact, when this started, my view was that Pakistanis would not be interested in long-form conversations with experts where it is a discussion as opposed to a fight in many ways. But we will actually like the more wonky, nuanced engagement. And I'm looking forward to that engagement today as well. And I want to begin with your book in particular, in the sense that you sort of lay out the things India did in the early 90s with, you know, post-crisis liberalization. There is this iconic image that many Indians still remember of their gold being flown out as collateral to secure the IMF deal. You would be very familiar with that as well. And after that, elites in India, political elites in India across the board decided once was more than enough, and we were not going to be in a situation where the IMF dictated to us in this way that hurt our own moral and reputational standing. And then the reforms journey begins from there in a long and steady process that continues to this day. We'll talk about the key factors of or the key things they did right. But the question I wanted to start with was, when you turn on Pakistani media or converse on the economy with Pakistani elites, they say we need a strong government, and only a strong government can deliver the tough reforms Pakistan's economy needs. And when I read your book or I read other analyses from Indian economic experts, I realize that India's journey began under a weak coalition government that risked its own stature and its own being, with Manmohan Singh sort of running the helm of the finance ministry and the economic affairs at that time, and delivered those reforms. So what is your view, given your research in this book on India, on how and why even a weak coalition against the popular belief in Pakistan was able to deliver such game-changing reforms in India?
Yeah. Well, I think this is a very pertinent question comparing the three countries. The lesson which I draw from the empirical analysis of India and Bangladesh is that it is not the form of the government, but it is the continuity, consistency, and predictability of economic policies by successive governments, which is the main critical factor. Let me preface that. Narasimha Rao started this journey in 1991. Indian business people and the foreign investors did not pay much attention to it. They appreciated this, they welcomed it, but they did not respond as positively as one would have seen or would have expected because of this paradigm shift from a centrally planned command heights economy to a more liberal economy till Vajpayee came to power. And you know, the BHP, BJP has always been a very much pro-market and pro reform party. And they said, oh my God, we got something as a gift from Narasimha Rao, and we will now run with it. And Vajpayee government finally decided to go further than the reforms. Not only they continued Narasimha Rao's reforms, but they went a step further and they said, we want to divest the state-owned enterprises also, which was not the part of Narasimha Rao, and also give benefits of opening up the foreign direct investment because there were some restrictions on the foreign direct investment, and they took away some of those restrictions gradually. And from that day on, Uzair, India has taken off because both the Indian business people as well as the foreign investor said, whosoever comes to power, it doesn't matter. Indian paradigm shift has taken place. It is rooted in very deep grounds, and we have no fear that our investment will bear fruits. And then, you know, Manmohan Singh, who was the architect of the 1991 reforms, became the prime minister for 10 years. And he ran with these same reforms. And then Mr. Muri, who was a Vajpayee and a very liberal and Gujarat chief ministership, he demonstrated that he used to take the private sector investors in his own car and show them the places where they can start their own businesses. Tata, for example, was kicked out of West Bengal, and he took them to Gujarat and said, pick any land you want for your nano, car. So that Modi regime has given further flip. And now the world around is saying a country of 1.4 billion people like China is now growing for the last 30 years at 6 to 7% per annum. This is unbelievable. So it was the continuity, consistency, and predictability of economic policies, which gave the confidence to the investors. And today, the foreign direct investment today in India is close to $70 to $80 billion. And it was a country, I remember when I was in the State Bank, we used to get $5 to $6 billion, and India used to get $12 billion, compared to 8 times the Indian economy. Today, they are getting $80 billion. And same story with Bangladesh. Till 1990, you had the military regimes, and there was a lot of political uncertainty, so nobody really wanted to do anything. But came Hasina Wajid and Khalda Zia. They were battling begums. They were rivals, bitter rivals politically, but their economic policies were exactly the same. And Bangladesh then from 1990 onwards has again does remarkable job, and their per capita income today is higher than that of India and Pakistan. So the lesson from this book, from this empirical analysis I came, is not the form of the government, democratic, military, oligarchy, or authoritarian, or hybrid, or anything. If you have the same set of policies where the investors feel confident that they will be able to earn the rates of returns on their investment, which they have postulated, then the country would take off.
I think that's a very important point. And again, on the Indian case, my analysis of it has been over the last 10 years or so, covering India's economy, its reform journeys on the economic side, etc. And even just a few days ago, on the eve of elections, Prime Minister Modi's government pushed forward a new policy to attract greater investments in the electric vehicle industry, giving basically a reduction in duties down to 15% for fully built electric vehicles over $35,000 a pop in return for companies who agreed to invest over $500 million in manufacturing in India with a particular domestic sourcing component, and agreements that sort of said we will grow this domestic sourcing and begin to export best-in-class electric vehicles out of India. And the government said, despite all the protectionism, despite all the big lobbies like the Tatas and the Mahindras, we are going to go ahead on the eve of elections to do this because it's the right thing to do. It will catalyze a step change in the economic trajectory of the country. They did that with the GST a number of years ago, a topic you're familiar with and have focused on as well. Again, the trading lobby is a very important lobby for the BJP and its voter base, and they finance and fund and organize the party at the grassroots level. But the prime minister and his finance minister decided, no, this was the right thing to do, and India needed a common market, and therefore we are going to do that. My question to you is, on continuity and stuff, isn't there a first step even before that, in the sense that I would argue Pakistan has had policy continuity in the sense that it has been nonsensical policy continuity on obsessions with a stronger currency or on obsessions with trade and non-trade barriers that are reducing consumer surplus and welfare. And perhaps on the Indian and Bangladeshi side, the first step was that they listened to common sense economic experts who sort of said, no, there is a particular pattern in which you can grow your economy and create jobs and grow exports. And in Pakistan, when I look at, I would love your thoughts on, when I look at the last 30 years, basically my lifetime, we have had people like Ishaq Dar in policy-making circles one time or the other, or people who are a variation of that mindset in other governments, doing the same nonsensical policy things that have brought us to this crisis that we currently are in. Isn't that the key factor as well?
I think I would take you back to the Nawaz Sharif government of 1991, 92, when Sartaj Aziz was the finance minister. And the reforms which they introduced, liberalization, deregulation, and privatization, were more severe in their impact as compared to Narasimha Rao's. But what happened? In 2 years, Nawaz Sharif was thrown out. And the economy during 2 years really did extremely well. The foreign investors started coming in, both on the portfolio side as well as the foreign direct investment. And there were privatization. But when the new government came in, they were not willing to give credit to their opponent, and they didn't continue with those policies. They started with their own policies on the IPPs. And therefore, there was a shift in the emphasis from those policies, which would have taken at least 8 to 10 years to get roots in the economy, and like India, would have produced results. But every 2 years, you have change of the regime. You had six prime ministers in the 1990s, and from 1999 to 2024, you had 16 prime ministers. Now
And
you
if I
tell
may,
me.
interrupt you here, and the point you have made, right, in the book is that you could have that change in prime ministers and governments, but if they continued the policy framework, they would
Yes,
have been fine.
exactly. That's what I'm trying to say. That what is the political economy aspect of it? And having worked in the government recently, I can share with you and your viewers, every prime minister is insecure in his job, that if he takes tough economic decisions, which are unpopular, but which are going to have results after 3 or 4 years, he's not plunging into that because he doesn't know whether he will continue after 2 years or not. My hypothesis is, and I may be wrong about it, it's more conjecture rather than hypothesis, that if you had continued with the 2017 government and 2022 government of both Nawaz Sharif and Imran Khan, the economic conditions of Pakistan in 2024 would have been extremely different from what the situation today is. So my argument is that because of the insecurity that they would be chucked out of the office, either extra-constitutionally or by some other machinations or political engineering, they don't have the political courage to take those decisions. And you know, as an economist, that tough decisions taken in the year one, two, or three will have the benefits after four and five. So from political economy point of view, the party in power can say, look, we made you suffer the pains for the first 3 years, but now the economy is really doing well and those pains have subsided. You again vote for us, and in the next 5 years, we will try to do better. And as everybody knows, the governance reforms are not coterminous with the electoral cycle. They take more time, at least 10 years, 15 years. So if you have a government which continues in power based on their record and not thrown out because of the political engineering, they can go to the electorate and say, look, we have done a good job. Now you give us another chance. And I can assure you that in 5 years, those deep-rooted reforms on the governance and institutions would have taken place. But that's my hypothesis, that's my conjecture. But if you are insecure and you do not know whether you will have the job tomorrow or not, or a vote of no confidence is being manufactured against you, or some judicial decision-making is going, even you and I would not hesitate to plunge into that kind of policymaking.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point, right? I mean, I'm living here in the United States in the post-Trump era. I've lived here since the Barack Obama era. And there's a pattern even to American economic reforms is the first 18 months is the opening for the president to do what he or she wants to achieve. And then it's about delivering and then going to the polls in year three and four and saying momentum is there, continue the job. This is what we've done. And this is what even Joe Biden right now is beginning to argue with the American people, that inflation is down. You know, my own home upstairs, I now have solar in part because of his policies, right? And I have tax credits that are improving efficiency in my home. And his argument to me will be, I delivered that for you. You are saving real money. Let's continue the job and not turn the system around because Donald Trump is going to be irrational, unpredictable, blah, blah, blah. And I think one example sort of as you were speaking, that came to my mind of the benefits of continuity in the Pakistani example is sort of the Benazir Income Support Program. And then now what is called ESAS, that when it was formed, there was a lot of criticism by the PMLN and then the PTI. But when they came to power, they thankfully and rightfully expanded it. The PMLN gave it more funding. The PTI tried to put a step change in the program, labeling it ESAS. We can debate about whether they should have changed the name or not. Different question. But they took it to the next level in COVID and post-COVID environment. And we see the fruits of that. This is a huge and a very important program for the poorest of the poor in Pakistan. And kudos to all three parties for continuing. So we have evidence of what good reform and a consistent policy posture can do. The question I had, you know, you alluded to, and I want to clearly draw that out as well, is they are insecure. And I would argue, and many political experts would argue that I've learned from, that insecurity stems from the very extra constitutional underpinnings of power in Pakistan, meaning that the prime minister is less beholden to his or her MNAs and parliamentarians, and more beholden to at times to Rawalpindi or at times to the Supreme Court of Pakistan, which engages in different types of games that are less to do with policy and what the people want and more to do with the internal machinations of power. Would you also then say, especially in the case, a comparative case of India, that even with weak coalitions, Indian politicians kind of know that power resides in the people. And in Pakistan, power still does not reside in the people, which leads to bad policy. Like Imran Khan's choice, for example, of the petroleum price freeze, to me, is a very modern case in point of what happens when he's insecure, a politician is insecure and decides to upend the apple cart. Is that a key differentiator in Pakistan that the military and the Supreme Court play this outsized role unconstitutionally?
If you take a historical perspective, I think you're absolutely right. But I take a more contemporary view, and my starting point is the 2024 elections. I could not think, being a very keen observer of the political situation, that a political party which has been completely wiped out of the scene, cornered, its leaders have been put behind the bars and not even allowed a symbol. And there is a bias throughout the system, which is so discernible, would be able to get 91 seats in the National Assembly. The people have voted out, and they have demonstrated that, yes, this party was unpopular with the establishment, and it was working against them in their interests. And they tried their best, but the will of the people did actually prevail. So that is a very positive signal, because the younger generation in Pakistan doesn't subscribe. You are, of course, middle of that. People like me were quite old. Our thinking and the millennials' thinking in Pakistan quite different.
Let's
And
not even get to
therefore,
Gen Z, which I, as a millennial,
well,
can't even relate to.
Gen Z will come in 2029. So I can predict that in 2029 things will be even worse. So it's a turning point, I would call. And I think the recent letter from the six judges of the Islamabad High Court to the Supreme Court, and Supreme Court's meeting with the Prime Minister and trying to form an inquiry commission, these are, I hope, some of the breaks which will put into place in order to have a smooth transition of a duly elected government by the people of Pakistan every 5 years. And if you give them a complete tenure of 5 years, if they make a mess, they will be kicked out. If they do a good job, they will be put in power in their positions. And that is what we require. So there is a turning point. There are events which are unfolding. I don't know which direction they are going to go, but at least there is some hope that we will have a break from the past, which you very aptly described was the scene in Pakistan.
Let me ask you a follow-on on this, right, Dr. Saab, is I agree there is an inflection point, and how it plays out remains to be seen. Hopefully, it goes for the better, because I think a Pakistan that is more democratic will automatically be more developed, is my fundamental principle view. The people know what they want, and Pakistani people from rural Pakistan and Balochistan to urban Lahore and Islamabad and Karachi are very mature politically. They know what is in their best interest. We just never trust them, or the certain elites in Pakistan don't trust them. The question I have, though, is right now we have a government in power that is once more beholden to unelected people in power as well. But it has to embark on a reforms journey for various reasons you outlined in the book, external debt, poverty growing, climate crisis, the region moving ahead, and they now being connected, seeing the region moving ahead, racing ahead ahead of them. The young are agitated because of that. But because it doesn't have legitimacy, it will, by definition, at least if I were to take your hypothesis forward, be insecure. And because of that insecurity, I would argue it cannot do the reforms that you are outlining in your book. How do you respond? Like, how do you see that? Because to me, that becomes a fundamental problem in this very major economic crisis.
I think to some extent it is an uncertain situation, but the appointment of Aurangzeb as a finance minister is an indication that this government really wants to do business differently. Because I know Aurangzeb for a very long time.
If I may interrupt, one quick thing as you answer. I was just reading this morning that the reconstituted CCI, Council of Common Interest, doesn't have Mr. Aurangzeb but has Mr. Dar in it, who's the foreign minister.
Well, that I think Council of Common Interest is very different. But as long as he is in the right forums, he has made it very clear that he's joining the government not only to sit on the chair, but to bring about very basic reforms, which are structural in nature, not band-aid, and not just getting the IMF program. So that is my hope, that the new finance team will have that particular mandate from both the establishment as well as the government of the day. SIFC, to me, is a very welcome move because the bureaucrats I saw in 3 years when I was member of the cabinet were more reluctant to even implement the policies which the cabinet had approved because they were scared of the NAB, of the FIA, of judiciary, of the media. Now, when SIFC gives the orders, for example, then they have no hesitation because they have somebody who's backing them up on the tough decisions. And one of the things I can tell you, which pleased me, I have been arguing for deregulation of the pharma products that outside the essential molecules of WHO, which are almost 200 to 300, all other prices of the pharma products should be completely deregulated so that we can compete in the international markets. Because pharma is one of the export potential which can lead us to $1 billion or so. And SIFC has taken that decision and has deregulated the prices of the non-essential molecules. Now, if they continue to do this kind of things, refinery policy, for example, bringing in the government-to-government investments, and they have even looked at the education policy. So what I'm saying is that if this apparatus, which brings in the provinces, the federation, and the military together for the greater good of the country, then I would say that I'm more optimistic. But I have to watch the situation as to how it unfolds. But this is an institutional vacuum which has been filled in. As you know, my job was institutional reforms. Well, where our problem was coordination failure. The federal government says 2,500 is the price of wheat. The Sindh government says, who are you? We will have 3,000 rupees as the wheat price. So Rahim Yar Khan now becomes a choking point. All the farmers from Punjab are bringing in their wheat to Rahim Yar Khan to sell it in Sindh. Now, how can you have a unified market when you have these kind of distortions? Because this was part of the coordination failure. We didn't have any institutional mechanism whereby we could bring the provinces and the federation together. So if SIFC is able to do that, then I'm quite hopeful with the new finance team, with Shehbaz Sharif, who is a reformer. And I've seen him in Punjab, and I've given him credit in my last book, Governing the Ungovernable, for getting things done. He's a doer. So if Shehbaz Sharif is given a hand, free hand, and the finance team is competent right now, and you have the SIFC, this combination, I think, is going to create a more benign environment for the implementation of the reforms. That is my expectation. How far this is going to happen or not, I cannot predict. But at least this is my beginning point.
Well, I have a more critical view of the SIFC in the sense that, you called it filling an institutional vacuum. I refer to it as if you short circuit the system so many times, you might get electrocuted as well. And this is rather than doing the reforms you argued on the institutional side, short-circuiting the system. I understand the logic of it, but I have a more skeptical view on this. But something you touched on that I want to build on a bit, because connected to your book as well, is you mentioned pharmaceutical products. Across the border, there's an entire industry on APIs, and we saw it in action in the COVID pandemic, providing vaccines to the world or becoming part of global supply chain. I'm talking about India's pharmaceutical industry. Pakistan could, you know, with this approach that you described, benefit from cheaper imports of inputs into Pakistan and then trading across the border and internationally. The same holds true for the energy markets in the Punjab. The same holds true for fertilizer and cement, on and on. There is an entire conversation in Pakistan on trade that misses consumer welfare as a fundamental argument of why trade needs to be liberalized. And even the Indians, with their high trade barriers with the world, are finally waking up to the benefits of a more liberal trade regime, tariff regime, and non-tariff regime to deliver consumer welfare. What is your view on the prospects and the benefits of improved trade relations with India in this environment?
Atlantic Council published my paper, Prospects for Promoting India-Pakistan Trade, back in 2011. And where, with the evidence, I demonstrated that it is a win-win situation, both for India and Pakistan. And more for Pakistan, because India is a much larger economy and we can benefit, particularly in the corridor between Punjab of India, Haryana, and Delhi, which is a unified market, which is very well connected. So that was the idea. We can't go to south, we can't go to the west, we can't go to the north, but at least this corridor is very powerful. And I had disaggregated HS code at two level to demonstrate where Pakistan has the comparative advantage.
If I may interrupt, I think if I'm right, the flight from Ahmedabad to Karachi is shorter than the flight from Karachi
right.
to Islamabad.
Absolutely. And from Lahore to Amritsar is 1 hour drive. So I had meetings in Amritsar and Chandigarh with the businessmen, and they were very excited Indian business. So let us put this in perspective. Pakistan was ready with a draft agreement of MFN in 2014, February. Khurram Dastgir Khan and Anand Sharma, who was the Congress Commerce Minister and a very capable person, was committed to it, had come to an agreement. And then when it was going to be ratified by the cabinet, Mr. Nawaz Sharif got a message from Mr. Modi that this is election year. So if you are going to give this agreement publicly, it is going to favor Congress. Wait till we come to power and we will implement this accord. That day and today, it's almost 10 years. There has been no movement. So it is not on the part of Pakistan. Pakistan is very much willing to do business with India. But when the foreign minister of India at every forum wants to put Pakistan down and says they are creating an industry of terrorism, now what do you think the prospects of India-Pakistan trade would be? We have to wait for the elections in India. And there are some friends of mine who think that Mr. Modi may change the tune and may decide that in his last term, he would go in the history as somebody who really normalized the relations between India and Pakistan. But you're absolutely right. The benefits are immense. And Pakistan being located between China and India, two big economies, and with the collateral benefits of the Central Asian republics and the Middle East, it is in a very good position to carry out the gains from the trade, both bilateral as well as regional.
I hope there is a step change post-elections in India, and the benefits I think would be immense. I think one thing I often remind my Indian colleagues who will say that have a different view, saying, "Oh, we don't need Pakistan and trade with Pakistan anymore." I point to them the ongoing crisis in Indian Punjab. It's a major economic crisis. There is an economic crisis in Pakistani Punjab, and the only way to sustainably solve for it is to create that unified market you alluded to as well. So, there is. And I think Prime Minister Modi realizes that this is why Kartarpur as a corridor has held up despite all the tensions in the last few years of the relationship. I want to move on to Bangladesh now, a country you are familiar with as well, and you've written about in your book. When I look at statistics in 1971, when Bangladesh was born and literally was burning, left burning, decimated by the retreating Pakistan army at the time, its GDP per capita was half that of West Pakistan at the time. This is the data I've looked at. And today, as you said, it has a higher GDP per capita than Pakistan, roughly 50% higher. So it's flipped everything from 1971 to 2023 and 24. What are some things the Bangladeshis did right that stand out to you from your research that Pakistan ought to learn from?
Well, good question. And I think this is something which I keep on telling my Pakistani audiences here whenever I travel within the country. Number one, you may have serious political rivalries like, Khalda Zia and Hasina Wajed. But if you allow the private sector to do things which are in the national interest, then you don't have to worry about the economic growth because the private sector is the engine of growth. So the food grain production in Bangladesh went four times from 1971 to 2022. That means that the farmers in Bangladesh became much better off, right? The ready-made garments, which didn't exist till 1990, are now $52 billion. The NGOs like Grameen Bank brought in the microfinance credit to the women in the rural areas. BRAC under Sir Fazl Ehsan Abed laid down the network of the schools in the rural areas. And the local NGOs with civil society managed the local clinics and the dispensaries and the family planning centers as trusts with the government giving the support. So
Which,
it
if I
was
may
all
interrupt
hand.
on the education point, in the early 90s, they started doing, which Pakistan is still trying to do, which is conditional cash transfers to put girls in school. And there is a big relationship between girls in school, incentivizing that, and population growth as well.
Yeah, that is true. But what I'm saying is, the approach was that the government was as weak and as rent-seeking as any government in South Asia. But they brought in a coalition between the private sector, the government, and the civil society. So when you have all hands on the deck approach, then it is a win-win situation. Everybody makes an effort. So the government did not do as much on the human development indicators as the civil society and the NGOs have done in Bangladesh. Number two, female labor force participation rate in Bangladesh is 38%. And I was amazed to see in India, it's only 23%, which is same as Pakistan. So when you have female labor force participation rate, you have collateral positive benefits on nutrition of the children, on the education and schooling, on the healthcare, on the environment in the domestic areas of the house. For example, no pollution takes place. And therefore, you have improvement in all the socioeconomic indicators as far as the nation is concerned. So female empowerment through female labor force participation rate, financial inclusion through microfinance, and investment in human development were the three major determinants of Bangladesh's growth story, which neither India nor Pakistan has followed. India has gone in a different direction. It has not used the NGOs and the civil society to the extent that Bangladesh has done. And Pakistan has only some stories like TCF or Indus Hospital or SIUT, but not at large scale. So the lesson I draw from Bangladesh is we should have all working together for the same goal, rather than have a blame game that the private sector is blaming the government is blaming the private sector, the civil society is blaming both the private sector and the government. If you have adversarial relationship, I don't think we are going to do this. And this is not a story about Bangladesh. You know that the three countries which I admire most, Japan, Korea, and China, they were known as Japan Inc., Japan Incorporated, Korea Incorporated, China Incorporated, where everybody worked together. The MITI in Japan used to bring in all the private sector actors because they say, you are going to do exports. You're going to do the production. How can we help you? How can we be of assistance to you? Unless we have this collaboration and working together between the three segments of the society, government, markets, and the NGOs, I don't think things will improve.
The other question Dr. Saba had was, and again, I did some research in for a book chapter edited by Ambassador Malia Lodhi in the latest Oxford book called Search for Stability. I looked at the role of the military Inc. You refer to Japan Inc. or Korea Inc. or China Inc. And my conclusion in that research was that it's a fundamentally distortionary player in the broader economy. The UNDP refers to it as the largest business conglomerate in Pakistan, but they are exempt from certain types of taxes. There are institutional ways in which they distort the market, in my view. And that really is a big challenge for the broader economy, the role of the private sector, deregulation, et cetera. What is your view on the ways in which military needs to be reformed? Because I wrote this piece some time ago on Nikkei Asia asking for military 2.0, a more reform-oriented approach. I still get hate over it as like an apologist for the military-industrial complex. My view was different, but I would love your thoughts on like, how do we reform this big, gigantic conglomerate?
I think this is the popular theme which you have just pointed out. But if you go to the chapter on military in governing the ungovernable, because this is an area of your interest, I have got empirical evidence for the entire Army Welfare Trust, Fauji Foundation, Shaheen Foundation, Barrier Foundation, all the commercial enterprises. And every one of the enterprise is actually paying taxes. They are not actually tax exempt. The foundations are exempt. And the foundations use the profits from these companies for a complete network of institutions like educational and health clinics, dispensaries for the sipais and for the lower ranks. So it's a welfare institution which is serving 7% of your population. The 4.5% is the total market cap of all the listed companies, Fauji Fertilizer, Fauji Bin Qasim, Askari Cement, Askari Bank. I aggregated all of them. So it's only 4.5% compared to Angro, compared to Tapas, compared to Manshas, compared to others. It is not that significant. And they are using the money in order to spend on welfare, which the government would have to do it. So I think there's a lot of misunderstanding. Where I had problem, which I have narrated in my own analysis, is that the role of FWO and NLC, who are given preferential treatment and who are not actually helping the construction industry in Pakistan to take off. The private sector is not really at the same level playing field as the FWO or NLC. And I argue that they should be given the same benefits and same privileges as the other private sector. Let them compete if they win the contracts, but they should not have an advantage. So these are two organizations, which I take to task for not being on the same level playing field. But others are not. You have fertilizer, you have Engro is a big player, Fatma is a big player, Fauji is a big player. So there's a competitive market there. So there's not monopoly or oligopoly of Fauji. So that's my view. And I've documented that. What I'm saying to you is in the chapter on the military, where is the military enterprises? I would refer you to see that.
Got it. Last question, Dr. Zad. This has been a wonderful conversation. One criticism, and we may have some nuanced disagreements on policies and things like that, but one criticism you get and I get quite often when we talk about deregulation or increasing the role of the private sector, or pointing out that, look, there is a model across the border in India that has some learnings for Pakistan. The pushback that often I at least get is, well, look at the growing wealth inequality in India. Look at the crony capitalism there. The Adanis and the Ambanis dominate, and the Tatas and the Mahindras dominate. And the average, there's been jobless growth, and the average Indian is not doing as well as the statistics would have you believe, et cetera, et cetera. And this whole notion of growing the pie so then it can be distributed is BS and doesn't really work like that. We need more equality, etc. What's your view on that? How do you
Oh,
respond to that criticism?
I exactly respond in the way the others feel, that Indian capitalistic model is not a sustainable model. We need comparative capitalism, market-determined capitalism, not the crony capitalism, where the state actually picks the winners and blesses them both with the benefits within the country and outside the country. And I think that to me is the difficult. If you look at the chapter on India and pain points, I refer to that. I'm very fond of the southern states of India. The five states of India are not doing crony capitalism. They are competing in international markets. They are going into those areas where there is a demand internationally. They are entrepreneurs. They are IT unicorns, and they are not touched by the crony capitalism. It is only in the northern part of India. In northern parts, per capita incomes are more close to Africa as compared to the southern, which are closer to East Asia. So you have a divergence taking place in India, regionally, income-wise, as well as gender-wise. So those are the pain points for India. But what worries me more, Ozair, is the fact which opened my eyes that 80% of employment today in India is in informal sector. The redhiwalas, the tokrewalas, the footpathwalas, rather than the wage labor. Your and my reading of the economic history is that when economic growth takes place, reallocation of labor takes place from the low productivity sectors to the high productivity sectors. And the high productivity sectors create wage and formal wage earning opportunities. That's not happening in India. They are going to add 12 million people every year in the labor force. It's a youthful population. There are no job opportunities. It is a jobless growth which is taking place in India. So these are two major pain points, which I point out in my book on India chapter: inequalities, crony capitalism, and jobless growth. And for a sustainable growth in the future, which creates jobs for the younger people, they have to revisit their policies. The social protection program is pretty good, but there is a gap between the social protection program, which takes care of the poor, but what about the lower middle income groups and the emerging upper middle income groups? Where are they going to get that? They're not going to get social protection. They're not going to get, they're not getting benefit from the growth itself. And it is a concentration where number of billionaires is increasing in India. And that is what worrisome, as far as I'm concerned. So I'm with those that this is creating distortions as far as the general welfare of the people of India is concerned.
I think Andy Mukherjee in Bloomberg this week wrote a very good analysis, sort of echoing what you just said. I will link that in the description for those who want to dive deeper. Andy's a great columnist and a watcher of the Indian economy, and I think he would agree with your points here as well. Last question to you, Dr. Saab. You're an economist. You've seen these cycles of potential reforms, halting reforms, some steps forward, some backward. If I were to tell you, ask you, what are some things you would like to see in the upcoming budget season? We know the IMF, World Bank spring meetings are around the corner. Mr. Aurangzeb will be here in Washington, primarily to negotiate a longer program. And the budget will be a very important milestone for this new government. What would you be looking for that reinforces your view that both Mr. Sharif and Mr. Aurangzeb are serious this time around for reforms?
Good question. There are many, but I'll choose only one, which is the bane of all our problems, which is fiscal consolidation. 60% of our economy today is outside the tax net, and we are overburdening our industrial and formal sector, the salaried class, and the people with the lower middle class with indirect taxes. That's not a fair incidence of taxes. So for God's sake, please bring in the retail, wholesale trade, the real estate, agriculture, the big landlords. I'm not talking of the small farmers, transport sector, lawyers, engineers, doctors, clinics, who are all outside the tax net today. It's inequitable, and it is not something which we can afford, because our gap between the expenditure and the revenues is widening every year, and we are just borrowing. And this year, out of your 9 billion of net federal revenues, 8.4 billions have gone for interest payments. So first, try to broaden your tax net. Second, target your subsidies, whether you're giving for energy or for other. And you have a very good platform, as you pointed out, and I totally agree with you, which is the Benazir Income Support Program. You have a National Economic Social Registry. Use that registry, have the cutoff point, and give the subsidies to the biz, rather than I'm also benefiting from the petroleum subsidy and from electricity subsidy and from gas subsidy. So you rationalize your subsidy budget, which will go down much significantly if you do that. And third, get rid of your loss-making state-owned enterprises, which are actually bleeding. I just give you one example, which will illustrate my point. In 2004, 2005, up to that time, HBL, UBL, and ABL used to get billions of rupees of subsidies for recapitalization because they were all running in losses. Today, these three banks, along with the MCB, privatized banks, are giving 250 billion rupees as corporate income tax only. Look at the turnaround from a loss-making from the exchequer to a contribution of 250 billion every year. And that can happen. And I have done, if you look at my website, I have 11 reports on the restructuring of these state-owned enterprises, from PIA, from railways, all the way to many other organizations. Please do that. And finally, which is a longer-term program, which won't happen in the budget, ask the provinces that they have now the money. They should accelerate the education, health, and drinking water, sewerage investments. For that, I am a great advocate of devolution to the local governments, because sitting from Lahore, you can't actually look at the problems of Toba Tek Singh and Attock at the same time. Empower, resource the local governments, elected governments, and you will have a better service delivery. But that will take a longer period of time. But that is the solution if you want the satisfaction of the general public. So that is my advice as far as the reforms are concerned.
I couldn't agree more, especially on the devolution point. I always give this example to my friends that I'm living in Washington, D.C. If I have an issue of my trash or water or gas, I go to my city councilwoman and her office, which is around the corner from me, and she fixes those things for me because I pay property taxes to the city of
Right.
Washington. It's just ridiculous to expect me. I'm in Washington, D.C., so it would be to Congress, but for a New Yorker or a Bostonian or somebody, God forbid, living in Santa Fe, Arizona, to go all the way to Washington or to the state capital and say,
Right.
hey, my roads are broken, fix it, my school doesn't work. It inserts competition and it generates political competition as well, a new level
Right.
of leadership in the country. I couldn't agree more. So, Dr. Saab, this has been a fantastic and enlightening conversation for me. Thank you so much for all the work you do, for the research you do. It helps many of us learn and understand the nuances of Pakistan's economy. Your books are a must read. I will link to them in the description for people to go and buy them as well. But before I let you go, what are two or three other books you would recommend to the audience?
Well, I think what you just mentioned, I've got a chapter also in Malia Lodhi's latest book, which is a volume of people who are really the thought leaders in Pakistan and who have contributed, you know, in different ways. So I would recommend that book very much to our audience. By the way, reading has become an extinct species as far as Pakistan is concerned. People really don't read books. When I used to go to India and I used to ask the publishers as to what is your first print order, they would say, oh, 100,000. And when, because Oxford has published my fourth books, so I used to ask them, what is your first print order? They would say 1,000.
I
So
think
you can
that
see
explains
the comparison.
a lot of the problem here as well.
Yeah, you can see the difference between the book readership. And in today's day of TikTok and Twitter and Instagram, the span of attention today is not for long podcasts or for reading the books. But I will continue doing what you are doing in the hope that there will be other people who will actually listen to these podcasts and try to engage in debates and conversations, because we don't have the definitive answers. We can provide you what our perspectives are, but you may have a different perspective. And the truth comes out when there is a contestation between the different ideas. So thank you very much for providing me this opportunity. And I hope that we will have this conversation sometime again.
Thank you so much, Dr. Saab. And I agree. I think the contestation of ideas and deep thought, I would say the lack of that in Pakistani discourse perhaps explains a lot of what has gone wrong, because we're talking about random stuff on mainstream that makes absolutely no sense to the broader polity that is the Pakistani people. So thank you for your research. Thank you for your time, for your analysis. And I hope to have you back on the podcast sometime soon. In the meantime, take care and khuda hafiz.
Khuda hafiz. Thank you.